Unit 2. Text 1. The Fine Art of Putting Things Off by Michael Demarest. Text. Never put off till tomorrow, exhorted Lord Chesterfield in 1749, what you can do today. That the elegant Earl never got around to marrying his son's mother and had a bad habit of keeping worthies like Dr. Johnson cooling their heels for hours in an anteroom attests to the fact that even the most well-intentioned men have been postponers ever. Quintus Fabius Maximus, one of the great Roman generals, was dubbed Cuncator, Delayer, for putting off battle until the last possible vinum break. Moses pleaded a speech defect to rationalize his reluctance to deliver Jehovah's edict to Pharaoh. Hamlet, of course, raised procrastination to an art form. The world is probably about evenly divided between delayers and do-it-nowers. There are those who prepare their income taxes in February, prepay mortgages, and serve precisely planned dinners at an ungodly 6:30 p.m. The other half dine happily on leftovers at 9 or 10, misplace bills, and file for an extension of the income tax deadline. They seldom pay credit card bills until the apocalyptic voice of diners threatens doom from Denver. They postpone, as Faustian encounters, visits to barbershop, dentist, or doctor. Yet for all the trouble procrastination may incur, delay can often inspire and revive a creative soul. Jean Carr, author of many successful novels and plays, says that she reads every soup can and jam jar label in her kitchen before settling down to her typewriter. Many a writer focuses on almost anything but his task, for example, on the coast and geodetic survey of Maine's Frenchman Bay and Bar Harbor, stimulating his imagination with names like Guggen's Ledge, Blunt's Pond, Hyo Hill, and Burnt Porcupine, Long Porcupine, Sheep Porcupine, and Bald Porcupine Islands. From Cunctator's day until this century, the art of postponement had been virtually a monopoly of the military. Hurry up and wait. Diplomacy and the law. In former times, a British pre-consul, faced with a native uprising, could comfortably ruminate about the situation with Singapore sling in hand. Blessedly, he had no nattering telex to order in machine guns and fresh troops. A U.S. general, as late as World War II, could agree with his enemy counterpart to take a sporting day off, loot the villagers' chickens and wine, and go back to battle a day later. Lawyers are among the world's most addicted postponers. According to Frank Nathan, a non-postponing Beverly Hills insurance salesman, the number of attorneys who die without a will is amazing. Even where there is no will, there is a way. There is a difference, of course, between chronic procrastination and purposeful postponement, particularly in the higher echelons of business. Corporate dynamics encourage the caution that breeds delay, says Richard Maldenbach, Bank of America Group Vice President. He notes that speedy action can be embarrassing or extremely costly. The data explosion fortifies those seeking excuses for inaction. Another report to be read, another authority to be consulted. There is always, says Maldenbach, a delicate edge between having enough information and too much. His point is well taken. Bureaucratization, which flourished amid the growing burdens of government and the greater complexity of society, was designed to smother policymakers in blankets of legalism, compromise, and reappraisal, and thereby prevent hasty decisions from being made. The centralization of government that led to Watergate has spread to economic institutions and beyond, making procrastination a worldwide way of life. Many languages are studded with phrases that refer to putting things off, from the Spanish mañana to the Arabic bukrafil mishmish, literally tomorrow in apricots, more loosely, leave it for the soft spring weather when the apricots are blooming. Academia also takes high honors in procrastination. Bernard Sklar, a University of Southern California sociologist who churns out 3 to 5 pages of writing a day, admits that many of my friends go through agonies when they face a blank page. There are all sorts of rationalizations: the pressure of teaching, responsibilities at home, checking out the latest book, looking up another footnote. Psychologists maintain that the most assiduous procrastinators are women, though many psychologists are, at $50 plus an hour, pretty good delayers themselves. Dr. Ralph Greenson, a UCLA professor of clinical psychiatry, and Marilyn Monroe's one-time shrink, takes a fairly gentle view of procrastination. To many people, he says, doing something confronting is the moment of truth. All frightened people will then avoid the moment of truth entirely, or evade or postpone it until the last possible moment. To Georgia State psychologist Joe Fagan, however, procrastination may be a kind of subliminal way of sorting the important from the trivial. "When I drag my feet, there's usually some reason," says Fagan. "I feel it, but I don't yet know the real reason." In fact, there is a long and honorable history of procrastination to suggest that many ideas and decisions may well improve if postponed. It is something of a truism that to put off making a decision is itself a decision. The parliamentary process is essentially a system of delay and deliberation. So, for that matter, is the creation of a great painting, or an entree, or a book, or a building like Blenheim Palace, which took the Duke of Marlborough's architects and laborers 15 years to construct? In the process, the design can mellow and marinate. Indeed, hurry can be the assassin of elegance, as T.H. White, author of Sword in the Stone, once wrote, "Time is not meant to be devoured in an hour or a day, but to be consumed delicately and gradually and without haste." In other words, pace, Lord Chesterfield. What you don't necessarily have to do today, by all means, put off until tomorrow.
Text 2. Gossip by Francine Prose. Once I met a woman who grew up in the small North Carolina town to which Chang and Eng, the original Siamese twins, retired after their circus careers. When I asked her how the town reacted to the twins marrying local girls and setting up adjacent households, she laughed and said, "Honey, that was nothing compared to what happened before the twins got there." Get the good gossip on any little mountain town, scratch the surface, and you'll find a snake pit. Surely she was exaggerating. One assumes the domestic arrangements of a pair of Siamese twins and their families would cause a few ripples anywhere. And yet the truth of what she said seemed less important than the glee with which she said it. Her pride in the snake pit she'd come from, in its history, its scandals, its legacy of good gossip. Gossip, the juicier the better, was her heritage, her birthright. That town, with its social life freakish enough to make Chang and Eng seem mundane, was part of who she was. Gossip must be nearly as old as language itself. It was, I imagine, the earliest recreational use of the spoken word. First, the caveman learned to describe the location of the plumpest bison. Then he began to report and speculate on the doings of his neighbours in the cave next door. And yet, for all its antiquity, gossip has rarely deceived its due, and its very name connotes idleness, time-wasting, frivolity, and worse. Gossip is the unacknowledged poor relative of civilized conversation. Almost everyone does it, but hardly anyone will admit to or defend it. And of these, only the smallest and most shameless fraction will own up to enjoying it. My mother and her friends are eloquent on the subject and on the distinction between gossiping and exchanging information. John got a new job is, they say, information. Hey, did you hear John got fired? Is gossip, which is, they agree, predominantly scurrilous, mean-spirited. That's the conventional wisdom on gossip and why it's so tempting to disown. Not long ago, I heard myself describe a friend, half-jokingly, as a much better person than I am, that is, she doesn't gossip so much. I heard my voice distorted by that same false note that sometimes creeps into it when social strain and some misguided notion of amiability make me assent to opinions I don't really share. What in the world was I talking about? I don't, of course, mean rumour-mongering, outright slander, willful fabrication meant to damage and undermine, but rather ordinary gossip, incidents from and analyses of the lives of our heroes and heroines, our relatives, acquaintances and friends. The fact is, I love gossip, and beyond that, I believe in it, in its purposes, in its human uses. I'm even fond of the word, its etymology, its origins in the Anglo-Saxon term gossip, for godparent, relative, its meaning widening by the Renaissance to include friends, cronies, and later, what one does with one's cronies. One gossips. Paring away its less flattering modern connotations, we discover a kind of synonym for connection, for community, and this, it seems to me, is the primary function of gossip. It maps our ties, reminds us of what sort of people we know and what manner of lives they lead, confirms our sense of who we are, how we live, and where we have come from. The roots of the grapevine are inextricably entwined with our own. Who knows how much of our sense of the world has reached us on its branches, how often as babies we dropped off to sleep to the rhythms of family gossip. I've often thought that gossip's bad name might be cleared by calling it oral tradition, for what, after all, is an oral tradition but the stories of other lives, other eras, legends from a time when human traffic with spirits and gods was considered fit material for gossipy speculation. Older children gossip, adolescents certainly do. Except in the case of those who are rare toddler fabulists, enchanting parents and siblings with fairy tales made up on the spot, gossip may be the way that most of us learn to tell stories. And though, as Gertrude Stein is supposed to have told Hemingway, gossip is not literature, some similar criteria may apply to both. Pacing, tone, clarity, and authenticity are as essential for the reportage of neighbourhood news as they are for well-made fiction. Perhaps more important is gossip's analytical component. Most people, I'm leaving out writers, psychologists, and probably some large proportion of the academic and service professions, are, at least in theory, free to go about their lives without feeling the compulsion to endlessly dissect the minutiae of human motivation. They can indulge in this at their leisure, for pleasure, in their gossip. And while there are those who clearly believe that the sole aim of gossip is to criticise, to condemn, or frequently to titillate, to bask in the aura of scandal as if it were one's own, I prefer to see gossip as a tool of understanding. It only takes a moment to tell what someone did. Far more mileage and more enjoyment can be extracted from debating why he did it. Such questions, impossible to discuss without touching on matters of choice and consequence, responsibility and will, are, might one argue, the beginnings of moral inquiry, first steps toward a moral education. It has always seemed peculiar that a pastime so conducive to the moral life should be considered faintly immoral. I don't mean to deny the role of plain nosiness in all this, of unadorned curiosity about our neighbours' secrets. And curiosity, where would we be without it, has, like gossip, come in for some negative press. Still, it's understandable. Everyone wants to gossip, hardly anyone wants to be gossiped about. What rankles is the fear that our secrets will be revealed, some essential privacy stripped away, and, of course, the lack of control over what others say. Still, such talk is unavoidable. It's part of human nature, of the human community. When one asks, "What's the gossip?" it's that community that is being affirmed. So I continue to ask, mostly without apology, and especially when I'm talking to friends who still live in places I've moved away from. And when they answer, recalling the personalities, telling the stories, the news, I feel as close as I ever will to the lives we shared, to what we know and remember in common, to those much-missed, familiar and essential, beneficent snake pits I've lived in and left behind.
Listening in and speaking out. A Magic Circle of Friends by Elvira Franco. Older than 40 and starting from scratch. I thought I was a unique item, but as soon as I looked round, I found a sea of women in similar positions. The little child in us has grown mature and middle-aged, almost to our surprise. We share a fear that sits in the back of the mind like a spider ready to pounce. But we've also developed determination, almost like a religion. We know we have friends. At least, I know my friends are with me, if not always, at least most of the time. And most of the time I need them, and they me. We reach over the phone lines for that word of comfort, the encouragement we need to go on when our own store of willpower has become depleted. Returning to school, I found my friends were my best fans. In spite of their own insecurities, they never failed to offer me the cheering I often needed to rewrite a paper one more time or to stay up one last half hour to reread a difficult chapter. After classes, we would go to a diner, a bunch of over 40 classmates. Working together on a project that we felt strongly about roused a part of us we did not know existed. While we were quite far from orthopedic shoes, bifocals were prominent. Underneath the artful makeup, we would measure the wrinkles on each other's cheeks across the table, almost as if these lines could form a cord to link us. It was a good time. For years, in a locked-up corner of our minds, we had held the unspoken fear that we might actually be brain-dead. We were finally giving ourselves permission to celebrate our minds. For some, it was a return to the carefree years of college. For others, a first-time discovery that learning can be both fun and exhilarating. Besides the intellectual surprises, we found joy in each other's company. And we delved in this newfound companionship with an intensity we did not know we could achieve outside of love and pregnancies. We were and are proud of our ages. We had, in fact, created a sort of bubble around us, a magic circle that follows us still and says we are bright, successful, caring, ambitious, and finally, ready to change the world. We will not do it, as we might have been ready to do at 20, pushing and fighting. We will do it instead at a slower pace, because along the way we have learned lessons both small and big. For example, that the world is in no hurry to be changed, and that we will have a better shot at it after a good night's sleep. We may not complete our plans by tomorrow, or even by the end of the week, because the details of our lives may interfere, such as a child home from college or a neighbor's emergency. They call us late bloomers. They call us returnees. We are sought by schools, thanks to the sheer numbers we represent, not to mention the life experience and the common sense that even the least bright among us brings to the classroom. We feel flattered and surprised, and our ego is strengthened by the realization that we are indeed quite capable. Graduation comes. The last papers have been handed in with anxiety. The test booklets carrying in their pages the very essence of our knowledge closed for the last time. Goodbyes, with promises and some tears, even a photograph to keep as souvenir. We've made it. Watch out, world. Here comes the mothers and the grandmothers, ready to push, cajole, smile, and negotiate to achieve those goals we did not have a chance to effect the first time around.